Rabbosai. So our limud of halacha every day as is a schus for the refuah of Yosef Dov Ben Chailin, Shlav Refuah Shlema B'korev, B'soi Shal Choyle Yisroel. So just to complete our discussion today, it's very interesting that two people came up to me after the shiur yesterday and said that they found it amazing or very interesting or unusual to them that the halacha would even bother with such things, which, like paskening the halacha, something which to us makes sense as common, simple hygiene. We're talking about drinking from other people's bechas and drinking from other people's cups, shiraim, eating shiraim from someone else, eating shiraim from a rebbe.
You can't have any harm.
What? Can't come to any harm. Okay, it's a mitzvah, right? Shluchim mitzvah, maybe not shluchim mitzvah, but somebody who does a mitzvah is not going to come to any harm. Then you can say the same about the Koshel Brocha. All the people who are drinking from the Koshel Brocha, the schoolers of the Koshel Brocha is going to protect them from the bugs and the spittle that's left over from the previous. Just two points to make. Sorry?
Shoyme
B'soyim Hashem. Very interesting where the Aleph comes from in the word P'soyim. Because it's not P'soyim, it's P'soyim, and the Aleph is silent. So it's very interesting because the word is Pesi. So I think there's a discussion about that, about where the letter Aleph came from.
Donny Yale as well.
What?
Donny Yale, not Donny Hale.
Donny
Yale.
Donny Yale.
Donny Yale is the name.
Uh-huh. Okay. Good.
Silent Aleph as well.
Yeah. So Al Kol Ponim, let's talk about just the last two inyonim in this. One is very interesting because we know today that boiling water is going to kill the germs. I don't know whether they knew about that hundreds of years ago, that if you boil water, that you can then, by boiling water, you can eliminate. But look at this. This is a sefer, the Dark Age Shuva. I need to look up when the Dark Age Shuva lived. The Dark Age Shuva, Simon Kufta Zayin, writes as follows. Nira, Sha'ein Zeraka Sha'ein Be'enom Beli Bishul. He says that's the hakpoda, that we shouldn't drink somebody else's leftover liquid, is only if you don't cook it afterwards. Masha Inkein, Kisha Shol, when he borrowed the drink from someone else, Ubishlo Machakach, and he boiled it afterwards, Ein Tzorach Loimei Bishlo Behemez Adova, and certainly if he added other things to it, then it's going to be a problem. Ach gamim bishlam be'enom belishon dov b'soichom, and even if he cooked them as they are, without adding any other ingredients to it, without any other products to it, mekol mokor ulai kil v'sharei yesh bozeh shinui mikafi ma sheshoalom. Now, Dark Age Shuva seems to say that once you boiled it, it's different. It's not the same as once you boiled it, it's not the same as it was when you were borrowing the drink from someone else to drink from it, but. Yeah, but on the other hand, from we would understand, as you say, that you've sterilized it, that you've actually killed the bugs by boiling it, and therefore we would understand the Dark Age Shuva maybe in more technical terms, and to say that therefore there won't be a problem. Ve'ein zeh bichlal mayim shu'ulim, says once you boiled it, then it's no longer a problem. The other thing to mention is that the mafoshim are mechalek between 1850 to 1930. So I don't know. 1913. So in 1913, how much did they know about boiling water, whether or not killing bugs? Maybe. But he seems to think that the hakpoda or the difference. The final thing is just to make a difference between wine and water. They said, right? When we talked about the mechaber speaks about that you can either wipe the edge of the cup, or pour some water from the cup over the edge of the cup in order to rinse it before you drink from it. They say that that's only mutter legaba mayim, because mayim, it seems, I don't know why, but mayim, they're not so makbid on the baltashkes element of it. But if it's wine, It says then you should wipe the edge of the cup. What that achieves, I don't know. We'll worry about that. But clearly it says in Halacha that you either wipe the cup or you pour over the edge. If you're pouring some away in order to rinse the edge of the cup, then that's okay with Mayim, but with Yain is considered Bal Tashchis. That's not an option, therefore you have to look for your other options in order to make it mutter for you to drink for someone else's kos.
Very good.
Started at the Torah Way in Northwest London, Monday, Kaf Zion 7, 25th of June, Rabbi Yitzchok Yeager, Shlita, Contemporary Halachic Shilas. This week's Torah is in front of the family Halibar, Lichwet Simchon, the Sum of Benji Khan, Nerio, and Batya Halibar, Chetifia. Class takes place on Wednesday, Mitzvashem.
Good morning, Rabbi Isai.
Good morning.
My name is Rabbi Yeager. I am from Eretz Yisrael.
You're stuck. Me too.
Rabbi Turner was here yesterday, no? Rabbi Turner?
Yes.
This is my friend. He also got stuck. He tried to get on the airplane this morning and he couldn't get on it. So, some contemporary shilas. So, interesting thing, we came from Poland. We were in Poland together. That's where we got stuck. And in Poland, so maybe some of you had family. So we went to Auschwitz. And in Auschwitz, that we give the students who we go with, the Talmidos, the opportunity of making the bracha, sh'asali neis la'avoisai b'mokam hazeh. Sh'asali neis when if a person goes to a place where a nace happens to them, so then each person to make a bracha. That's halacha. An individual level. It's also true on a national level. On a national level, the places where nisim happen to Klal Yisrael. So those places, the place like Avarus, Moab, where Klal Yisrael came into Mitzrayim, came into Eretz Yisrael. So there also, you can make the bracha for Klal Yisrael. This is a individual bracha. The person themselves can make the bracha. The descendants can also make the bracha. So there's a discussion about to what extent can descendants make the bracha? To what extent? Children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. So Chazal teaches that the rachamim of parents to their children carries on for two generations. Parents and grandchildren. But great-grandchildren, then the emotional connection, the connection is no longer as strong. Nonetheless, the Mishnah Berurah says in Siman Reish Yud Ches that a person, a grandchild, would be able to make the bracha Baruch Shasein Es La Avoisai B'Mokom Hazeh, because assuming they were born after their great grandparent was saved. Now it doesn't have to be that way. It could be as a great grandparent and a great grandchild. The great grandparent had some kind of event. Their life was saved because of it. And then the great-grandchild wouldn't make a bracha in that place because they're not existent because of the nace that happened. But for the people who went through the torturous conditions of Auschwitz, so when they survived, it's certainly a nace. Anybody who came out of their life was a nace. And the great-grandchildren, therefore, could make the bracha. So Rabbi Turner shared with me that happened the following thing. One time it happened that there was a Talmida who came on one of these trips whose grandmother was in Auschwitz, and she made the bracha. And then after she made the bracha, in the discussion, it turned out that her grandmother was a twin, and the evil Mengele, Yimach Shemai, Zichrei, had done experiments on her. To the extent that she wasn't able to have children. So if she's not able to have children, how could she have a granddaughter? So it turned out the granddaughter's father was adopted. But nonetheless, the grandchild wasn't oymed on this nekuda, didn't realize, and she made the bracha. So the question was, now what? Well, now what? There's no now what, because the bracha's already been made. There's nothing to do. Nafkamin is, do you say Baruch Shem or not? So anyway, it's a bracha of a tzaddik, say baruch shem. Lamaisa, there's a discussion when it comes to parents and adopted children, to what extent depending on perhaps what age the parents will adopt the child, to what extent the child is regarded as a child or not. We know that Chazal say that kol ha-megadel yosom b'soch b'esoy ma'ala alav ha-kosov ki'ilu yoldoi. Whoever raises a child in the house, so the posuk, Chazal posuk, regards as if they gave birth to that person. If they gave birth to that person, so that obligates them in all lachas of kibud av aim and all the other ramifications of being a normal parent-child relationship. But that's not the halacha. The halacha is not like that. The Maaseh is a fascinating proof to that, nonetheless, from Yosef HaTzadik. Yosef HaTzadik. We know that who did Yosef HaTzadik get married to? The Osnas Bas Potiphera, Pasuk says. Osnas Bas Potiphera. Now, who was Osnas Bas Potiphera? So she was Potiphera's daughter, the daughter of, right? Now, that's why Mrs. Potiphar decided that she needed to make a relationship with Yosef HaTzadik, because she saw in the stars that she was going to have a child through him. She got it wrong. It wasn't her, it was her daughter. But it wasn't her daughter. It was the daughter of Dina from Shechem. It wasn't her daughter at all. But for some reason, the brothers of Shiftei Kar, when this daughter was born to Dina, they didn't want the daughter in the house, and the Malach took the daughter down to Mitzrayim and ended up by Potiphar and Mrs. Potiphar. So Mrs. Potiphar raised Osnas. And to the extent that she raised Osnas, she saw in the stars that she's going to have a child through her through herself or her daughter, through Yosef HaTzadik. So there is some kind of remez, at least in the Midrashim, to this concept. Nonetheless, it isn't the halacha. It's not the halacha. So the Talmid shouldn't have made the bracha, but there was an interesting thing that happened. Okay, sorry. Yeah.
Do you ask each Talmid whether or not she is the descendant of someone who was saved from Auschwitz?
Yes. Yeah. Well, we did it when we were there. We went to Auschwitz and we did the... And then Rabbi Turner said, you know, is anybody here whose parents or grandparents or great-grandparents...
So they don't all make the bracha?
No, they don't all make the bracha. No. Yeah, only the ones who had ancestors there. The question is what's going to be as time passes, and it's no longer a question of great-grandchildren, but great-great-grandchildren. You know, it was a long time ago. So as time passes, that's going to be the question. That discussion is not mentioned in the Mishnah Berurah. How many generations do you go when an individual nays? I don't know the answer to that question, but that's an interesting question. Okay, that was one question I wanted to share. The bracha of Shasli Nesim and Reshu Lechesen Arachayim. A girl asked me yesterday the following question. She has a glass pasta sauce jar. A glass jar that she bought with pasta sauce in. She finished the pasta sauce. She had enough pasta to finish all the sauce. Now she wants to use that jar for iced coffee. A cup for her iced coffee. Do you have to tovel it? That was the question. Because glass requires, as we know, so metal, if you buy a metal kli from a Gentile, so you have to tovel it. Yeah. If you buy a glass kli from a Gentile, the midrabanan has to be toveled with a bracha. Right. You have to tovel it. So the question is, when you buy a glass jar that has pasta sauce in it, are you buying a glass jar or are you buying sauce? So Rav Moshe Feinstein has an extraordinary chiddush where he says that you're not buying the jar. The jar is irrelevant. The jar is like a peel of a banana. When you buy bananas or oranges and you go to checkout and you say, well, what is it? It's oranges and the orange peel. You don't say that. You're buying oranges. It happens to be, has the peel. But when you buy a bottle of wine, you don't say, I'm buying a bottle of wine and I want to buy the bottle as well. No, the bottle is irrelevant. It's just a convenient way of bringing it home. So therefore, you haven't bought a kli. When you, says Rav Moshe, when you finish the pasta from the glass jar, so now you created a kli. Because then tell them there wasn't a kli. So if you create the kli, then you're Jewish. If you're Jewish, there's no chayv tevila. Brilliant. That's what Rav Moshe says. Rav Moshe says this sfora works specifically for glass. Because glass is a chayv tevila derabanan. It's a great sfora. The logic is clear. But for a metal jar, he wouldn't say that. Now, that notwithstanding, a metal jars work differently than glass jars. A standard glass jar, you have the glass jar, and then the lid is a screw-on lid. I think that's the standard way Glassjaw works. So your investment of energy, of creativeness in this jar is very minimum. You're not really doing so much. You're just unscrewing it. In contrast, a metal jar, a tin can, usually you have to do much more significant action in order to create that tin can. You have to use a can opener like you used to use back in the day, you know, telling you to turn, or you would use they have pull things, right? A ring pull these days, so you can open them easily. The fact that you have to do much more of a constructive act on opening the can, a tin can, that would seem to imply even by the metal can, you are making something. And the demonstration is like this. The proof to that is from Hilchos Shabbos. We know that the Chazon Ish wrote about Hilchos Shabbos. Chazon Ish lived 80, 90 years ago in Eretz Yisrael, and he wrote that back in the day, when you used to buy a tin of sardines, you were literally buying two things. You're buying the sardines and you're buying the tin, because there was no plastic containers available. Nothing was available for you to be able to store your bits and pieces in. And the Chazon Ish writes, what do you mean? Everybody stores their nuts and bolts and bars of soap in their tin cans. That's like a standard thing, not to throw away a tin can. Because people then would store things in their tin cans, they would not throw them away. So therefore the Chazon Ish says, when you open a tin can, you're creating a kli, because you're going to be keeping it. Interestingly, when I was teaching this to some of the Talmidos, so one of the Talmidos says, her family moved 7 or 8 years ago from Ukraine to America. Now her family lives in America, but they lived in Ukraine. And in Ukraine, they still keep tin cans to this day, or at least seven, eight years ago. The country is not so sophisticated and developed that you can buy a Tupperware container and a plastic container for your storage and the soap dishes. It just didn't have that. So in Ukraine, at least 7 or 8 years ago, I don't know if it's changed today, maybe it depends where, but a tin can also, a person wouldn't be able to open on Shabbos because people would be keeping it. The same is true to a certain extent. There are certain tin cans that people do keep today as well when they open them. For example, if you have a can of pickles or of olives, so many people, they open it and then they don't finish the can immediately, they leave it in the fridge. At least we do that in Eretz Yisrael. Maybe in England they don't do that. But in Eretz Yisrael we do that. The inside of the can is lined with plastic to prevent erosion of the tin, which may or may not be dangerous. So when we open a tin can, we open and we leave it in the fridge. So that would be the same problem of the Chazon Ish. But because the Chazon Ish says this, that demonstrates the fact that you would not be able to open a tin can, a metal tin can on Shabbos Kodesh, on the possibility of you keeping it, demonstrates that you made the tin can. If you made the tin can, then presumably the logic that Rav Moshe Feinstein says about a glass jar would also apply to a tin can. Because a glass jar, you simply unscrew it, yet nonetheless, it's regarded as if you made it when you finished the pasta sauce inside of it, and you wouldn't require it to be tovled. Similarly, by the tin can, you're actually making the tin can because you're either pulling the ring pull or you're using a can opener. So you're actually making the tin can because you're making the tin can. So therefore, according to the logic of Rav Moshe, also, it wouldn't need tevila. But the fact is, there aren't so many metal cans of that nature that are relevant to that discussion anyway. The other part of it, so even though in theory, when you open it, you're creating a kli, but nonetheless, it's not so practical because people don't really keep those things for food that would require them to do tevila on it anyway.
A glass bottle
with the same shayla, exactly the same shayla.
Nobody said you've got to close the heart. Half bottle of lemonade, but you don't put it.
No, if you want to use it again, if you finish the contents.
While you're using it.
So there are poskim who are machmir about that as well. Like buy a coffee jar. For a coffee jar, if you have a coffee jar, your Nescafe or Toaster's Choice, some poskim are machmir, you've got to pour out all the coffee, tovel the jar, and then put the cock back in again. Or you could keep it in a plastic container, which is drop easier. But that's it's not necessarily the mainstream opinion in halacha, and it's not something we necessarily recommend. The difficulty with tovling any kind of glass jar is usually going to be the label. Because if you had a jar like this student had, a pasta sauce, it probably had a label stuck on the outside that said pasta sauce. And usually we would say, if you have a label stuck on the jar and you don't want that label to be there, she probably doesn't want to be drinking an iced coffee out of this glass with a pasta sauce label on it. Probably. But it's very difficult to take it off. So they stick it on in a way which is, you know, very, it's a gesunden stark, you know. It's stuck very firmly, it's very hard to get it off. That's another practical problem. So I told her, the answer I told her is that why are there opinions who would require you to tovel this kli? Because it's a remote chiddush after all. Yeah, but if you wouldn't tovel it, that would be okay. That's what I told. That's the question about the tevilas kelim. Okay. Yesterday, Talmida asked me the following question. She's having a milchik meal. She's having people over for a milchik meal, and she wants to make a fruit salad, and she wants to cut fruit with a meaty knife for the fruit salad, for the milky meal. Is there any problem in using a meaty knife to cut fruit for a fruit salad that'll be eaten at a milky meal? So usually, the Rabbanim like to say, keep milk for milk and meat for meat, causes less problems. In this situation, there are more considerations than just to be cautious. What other considerations are there? So I asked her, why is a knife meaty? That's always the first question we have to answer. Ask, why is a knife meaty? Is it a meaty knife because you use it to cut vegetables up on the meaty side of the kitchen, but it doesn't actually cut meat? Is that why it's a meaty knife? Or have you actually used it to cut meat? And the meat that you cut it with is actually hot meat. Now, meat from a cow, as it were, a roast, people don't usually cut when it's hot. You appreciate that if you have a roast and you cut it with a knife, then that knife will become meaty. If you have a roast which is cold, or a cold piece of chicken, and you cut it with a knife and a fork, it won't become meaty. Because only through the action of heat, of the item that you're cutting, the hot piece of meat or the hot piece of chicken, that will cause absorption of tan, absorption of taste into the knife and make it meaty. But if that didn't happen, if the only reason the knife is meaty is because it's on the meaty side of the kitchen, it's washed in the meaty dishwasher, it's washed with a meaty kalim, it's not actually meaty at all.
If you wash it in a bowl, hot water,
if you wash it, if you have a washing up bowl, and you put all the kalim in, the dirty, fleshy kalim in, there's probably 60 times, probably shishim, against all the meat in the water.
Yeah.
Probably. Because the amount of meat which is in the bowl, all the large amounts of meatiness left over from the meal, you scrape it into the bin, and you have a little bit of gravy and juice left on the plate, a bit of dirty. But when you have the bowl full of water, there's going to be 60 times more water than the meat, and therefore, it most likely won't make any other knife, fork, spoon get put into the water meaty. Right. There's a chashash of a nitzuk chibur. That when you have if the hot water urn is on, if the hot water system is on, and the water's constantly getting hot, when you turn the hot water on, you open the hot water tap, so then the hot water comes out of the tap, and that's a nitzuk chibur. The water coming out is connected to that water. It's called iru kli rishon, and iru kli rishon is mevashel. That's true. But whether or not that's not going to affect the water in the bowl, because the water in the bowl is certainly cliche-y. The only question is, are you going to have a meaty plate and a potentially power of utensil lying in such close proximity that's going to cause a transferal of tam one from the other? So it's unlikely to happen, but it's a consideration. That's one of the reasons we have separate milk and meat.
You wash the plate or the knife in a fleshing machine.
A dishwasher. Also, so dishwashers work different ways. The poskim discuss the dishwashers. First of all, it's usually a rinse. Yes. Before, you know, Jewish housewives don't trust dishwashers to wash the dishes. They always rinse them first. That's just the reality. I don't know if non-Jewish people also don't trust their dishwasher. Dishwasher can probably do a good job, but we don't trust our dishwashers. We rinse the dishes off first. After we rinse, usually a decent cycle in a dishwasher, it's going to have a rinse cycle before the soap comes out. If the rinse cycle, when the thing fills full of water, and it's going to be shishim water against the meatiness that's left on the plate, so that amount of water, it's going to be bottled by shishim. That's the pashtus. The significance of that, but it depends how the dishwasher works, depends which cycle you set it on. When the soap comes out, the soap is pogaim. The soap has an effect of spoiling the tam of the meatiness of the water that might become meaty through the mixing with the meatiness on the plates. That's pogaim anyway, but usually the soap doesn't come out immediately. Usually it has a rinse first, in case your dishes have been sitting there for a number of hours, and the dirt has already become encrusted. So usually there's a rinse at the beginning. And that rinse isn't necessarily out of lettuce. I checked our dishwasher at home, and it says the original rinse, the first rinse is 40 degrees. So like Ramosha, 45 degrees is yatsa lettuce. So if the original rinse, you can check your models at home if you still have the instruction booklet to see how it works. One of the first thing you throw away with the box, right? But I know how to use these things, right? Right, so it will tell you which cycle you're going to put on, what temperature of water it's using, and that will have a ramification if by mistake you have a milchik, something gets mixed into your fleishig dishwasher, where there's going to be, usually it's not going to make it treif, and even if it makes it treif, you just turn the kettle on and pour boiling water over the item. It's going to kasher it now. Because the extent that the dishwasher itself made it treif is not so not a very strong, powerful level. So pouring boiling water over it from the kettle is going to kasher it. So one element was, why, I asked the Talmida, why is the knife meaty? Why is the knife meaty? She says, no, she has sliced hot meat with the knife. She has. Fine. So now, so we've clarified, therefore, it's meaty. Now, did she slice hot meat with a knife in the past 24 hours, rendering the knife a ben yomo? No, she didn't. She didn't know, which means she didn't. So that means the term of meatiness that's absorbed in the knife is not significantly meaty because it was there for more than 24 hours. Nonetheless, I still questioned her and I said, which fruits do you want to be cutting up for the fruit salad? So she has various fruits, including citrus fruits, grapefruits, and oranges. Now, I don't know if you get this, but in Eretz Yisrael, beginning of the winter season, we get the oranges. The oranges, orange itself is very very strong. It's sharp. It's harif, because we get them when they're greenish still. But either which way, throughout the year, the peel round an orange or the peel of the grapefruit is certainly going to be a davar harif. At least lachatchila will call it a davar harif. Like an onion is a davar harif. What's the ramification of that? That even if the meaty tam has been absorbed into the blade of the knife, was absorbed more than 24 hours ago, but nonetheless, when you cut something which is sharp, that's going to revitalize that tam from the knife and make ostensibly the fruit meaty. So that's what we discovered. So she said, the truth is, it's only the pineapple she wanted to use the meaty knife for. Because the meaty knife is the big knife. You see, sometimes the Rav has to ask a few questions, then finally you get to the bottom line and see exactly what does she want to do. Because the pineapple is big, it's a fresh pineapple, she wants to use the meaty knife, it's a bigger knife. But she has a smaller knife, which she can use for the citrus fruits. So that's what we decided, that's what she's going to do. She's going to be using the large meaty knife. She can use it on the pineapple, because the pineapple is not sharp at all. Now, the fact is, you're obviously querying, but maybe the knife isn't clean. Now, it's true. The Shulchan Aruch says that back in the day, if you would not be able to use a meaty knife to cut something for milk. There was a designated, for example, bread knife. There was certainly parav. You wouldn't be able to use a milky knife for bread or a meaty knife for bread, because a knife, we would certainly assume, is dirty. That was the assumption back in the day. These days, however, the poskim say it's no longer relevant. Shulchan Aruch says it's a problem to do that. You wouldn't be able to do that. But these days, poskim say it's not a problem. Why? First of all, the metal that our knives are made with is much more, it's higher quality, and therefore it's much smoother and it's easier to clean. And also, the method that we have for cleaning our metal is much superior. We have various scotches and various brushes and sponges that make our knives as new each time we use them. So even though Shulchan Aruch says it's true, if you can't use a meat, if you use a meaty knife to cut something milky, you have to cut it off or rinse it or something like that. But assuming the knife is clean, and you'll know the knife is clean, so then we're not choshish for that anymore. So that's the shalom with the vegetables, the fruits for the thing. Again, so we told them, first of all, clarification, is the knife really meaty or not? And if it is, we shouldn't be using it for citrus fruits. Once we had a fascinating question with a Talmidah who was working in an office in Eretz Yisrael, and in the office which she was in, it wasn't a from work environment, which isn't great, but whatever it is, and there were offices dotted around the country, and as one of the things which the office did for all the staff was every day they got a delivery of fresh oranges, and they had a hand squeezer. You know, you cut it in half, you press the thing, and you get a cup of fresh orange juice whenever you need to revive yourself so you can carry on working at your task. And she wanted to know, can she use that squeezer? Now, it wasn't a frum office, and they had branches all over the country. So the assumption was that they signed a contract with a farm somewhere that they should get delivered 20 oranges to each office every day, fresh oranges. Now, an orange, like we said, the skin of an orange, the peel of an orange, is certainly a charif. So the trouble is, you appreciate that in Eretz Yisrael, you have to mafrish trumas and maestras, and there's also a problem of orla. Now, orla, you can't do anything about. If the orange fruits are orla, then they are orla, and you can't wave a rabbinic magic wand and make them not orla anymore. Not all the heksherim in Eretz Yisrael are makpid on the percentages of orla which the poskim recommend, for whatever reason. It's a very hard thing to keep on top of. It requires a high level hashgacha to know that the tree hasn't been, fruit trees work better when they're younger. So after a tree has been for a few years, they'll chop a branch and they'll start again, they'll replant it, and it's a more effective way of growing fruits. So you always have to be in the know as to what extent any particular fruit that you might possibly buy is going to have a problem of orla. And apart from that, you have trumas and maestras. So even though she could potentially be mafrish trumas and maestras on the orange which she wants to be squeezing, but the previous person who was a mafrish trumas and maestras, knows the squeezer itself has absorbed tevel, which is the fruit before trumas and maestras are being separated, tevel, right? So that would mean the whole squeezer is actually treif.
Cold.
Yeah, but it's harif. The peel of the orange, because you press it, the pressure, which is applied on the skin to get the juice out, we regard that as like a duchka the sakina.
The peel isn't harif.
Yeah, the peel, yeah, sharp.
It's only the orange which has acid.
Right. Okay. So there are different amounts. It could be you're right. Our understanding then was that the peel itself was harif, and there could be different parts of the peel. Some of the peels were some of them weren't. Either which way, yeah.
You squeeze the orange from the top.
Right.
Cut in half, squeeze it from the top.
Right.
So the peel doesn't touch the machine at all. It's only the orange inside which gets squeezed.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we assumed that it would have been a problem, and it could potentially have absorbed blears of tevel in the machine. So it could be that we were not accurate about that. That's what we assumed. Either which way, it's just raising the issue, especially in Eretz Yisrael, Mitzvah, when they open the skies again and you come to visit Eretz Yisrael, you have to be aware there are significant kashrus challenges in Eretz Yisrael, and you want to maintain the same high standard of level of kashrus that you maintain in you know, Eir HaBira, in this holy city. So when it comes to Eretz Yisrael, you've got to be very careful, because not all the kashrus maintain the same standard. Okay, Rabbosai, have a wonderful day. Bracha v'atzlacha.
I don't understand. You're afraid he's touching the side of the freezer. I didn't get it.
The squeezer.
The squeezer.
The squeezer, because it's duchka.
You say the freezer?
The squeezer.
Okay,
it's good. Right, it's my